It's a good effect. I'm sitting down.
It is.
With my out angling, our arms are the exact same size. And I'm like 5 feet closer to the camera.
Nothing like a little perspective, is there?
Mm-hmm. Recorded live at Super Training Gym in Sacramento, California. This is Mark Bell's PowerCast.
Did we offer Stan a monster?
I don't know. I don't know if he drinks caffeine. And,
you don't want me on caffeine.
All right.
Nobody get a word in edgewise.
Alongside Silent Mike and Jim McDee, here's your host, Mark Bell.
You drink any caffeine pre-workout or?
No.
Nothing?
No. No,
fat burning? Nothing?
Mm-mm. I work out to burn fat.
What? Go. That sounds ridiculous.
It's crazy.
You exercise to keep yourself in shape?
When I could take a drug instead. That's crazy.
Oh, my God.
Did you see the new commercial by, it might be like Coca-Cola or Pepsi. They're teaming up with something. And they're like, we're teaming up to teach kids the days you don't exercise, eat less food. And then like slaps a picture of a salad. And then like the days you do play, and then shows kids playing basketball, maybe you could have better things. And then like slaps a can of Coke up. I was like, what are you talking about? Like, yeah, like in essence, that's fine. Eat more when you work out hard, eat less when you don't. But like a Coca-Cola on the day you work out hard for a 12-year-old kid,
okay,
he can't think about
that. I want my kids on caffeine.
Yeah, why not?
I won't even feed them carbs. I just want them to be in a coma all day.
You want them to be slow and not be able to think.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, pounds of meat. Just put them to bed.
Bacon.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are here today with Stan the Rhino Efferding, a, I guess, former world record holder, but still has a couple world records, maybe without sleeves. Do you have the without sleeves squat record
still? He's without sleeves today as well.
I don't know. I held all the world records in the absence of Eric Lillibridge.
Yeah, son of a bitch. Yeah. Oh, yeah, he broke. Yeah.
But he did three.
Well, wait. He did 308.
Yeah, were your sleeveless 275?
Your 854 squat is probably still intact, right?
Yep. I think that one's still there.
Is that the sleeveless 275?
That's the 275 no knee wrap.
Yep. Anyway.
There's some freaks out there, though.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're here with Stan the Rhino Efferding, who hit up some huge squats back in the day, huge benches and huge deadlifts. I believe best squat you were credited with in competition is 865, correct?
I think so.
A 606 bench and an 837-pound deadlift. Along with that, he is a former pro bodybuilder. He was a pro bodybuilder the same time he was hitting up those huge squats and huge deadlifts. And in my opinion, he's one of the reasons why raw powerlifting is where it is today, because I think a lot of people saw the videos that we were pumping out at supertraining.tv, courtesy of Jim McDee. And I think a lot of people saw those videos. You did the World's Strongest Bodybuilder. You went head-to-head with Johnny Jackson. And we all know what happened to Johnny Jackson.
Yeah, one of those promos was like one of the first videos I think I saw of Mark and you. You calling him out. It was like maybe right after a meet?
Yep.
With was, Flex, yeah. Maybe? That was like one of the first videos I saw.
That was right after I got my pro card.
Yeah.
Yeah. I competed in bodybuilding 2009. Trained with Flex over in San Jose for a couple months. Got my pro card. And then drove straight over here and started powerlifting.
I think a lot of people, you know, including myself, were extremely motivated to see, like, here's a guy who's lifting these huge fucking weights. But he's not fat. Yeah, 5 pounder right over his head. 5 pound curl, 5 pound.
What were you on stage around that time?
250.
And then you competed, didn't cut, and just bloated a little bit and got around 260 or something?
Bloated a lot. No, when I came here and we got to probably 285 before water cut. That was over a 7-week period, from 250 to 285. Lost
that was insane.
That was just hanging out with fat Mark Bell at the time.
That's an interesting story. Let me talk about that real quick.
Well, first of all, we went to go eat. I think we went to what the fuck's the name of that place? God damn, what's it? Jack's Urban Eats. I think we went to Jack's Urban Eats and sat down with Stan. And Stan was doing really well business-wise at the time. And I remember sitting down with him, and he told me of his goals. I think at that point you hit like a 2050 total or 2025.
2070, I think. That was here in SAC. That was a three lift.
And I saw the video of you lifting in an APA meet.
Yeah, you remember the federation? That was APA.
I remember the meet. It was just down the street from Super Training.
Gotcha.
And I remember seeing the lifts, and I remember hearing you going, bah, 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 you know, all the different noises you make and shit. and with the bald head and everything, and just your white complexion and everything, I was just like, who's this like German guy shouting out all these weird commands while he's lifting? But I remember seeing that video, and then I contacted you. I think I might have hit you up through like YouTube or something like that.
Yeah, I
even.
Think so.
I was like, wow, those lifts were fucking amazing. You hit those lifts just down the street from my gym. My gym's super training. And I think shortly thereafter, you came to visit. Then we went to go eat. We went to lunch, and you told me of your goals. You're like, I want to try to break some of the all-time world records. You know,
yeah,
that's why I'm here.
At the time, it was KK.
Yeah.
Had the records. Constantin had the three lift records.
Right.
No knee rep and knee rep, I think, somewhere around there.
That guy's a freak.
Yeah.
So yeah, and that was the goal.
I wasn't even training for powerlifting. I was just training at an LA Fitness up in Tacoma.
Right.
And so, but I always like to train heavy. So I hadn't specifically ever been to a powerlifting meet or worked with a powerlifting coach. But I just, I pulled those numbers off of powerlifting watch.
Right.
And I saw, this is the 275 world record, so let's do that.
Right. And I remember Jim filmed some of the footage of you, you know, physically writing out the total and stuff that you wanted. You kind of calculated it. You had a whole plan going into the meet and everything. But I remember that first day we sat down and you said, I have no idea what you charge for training or anything, but here's, you know, you just slid money over to me. It was like $5,000 or something, just stacks of hundreds. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, I don't know I'm going to charge that much, but like whatever way you want to do it. But what you said to me, though, is you said, no, I want to train. I want to do what you're doing. I want to train side by side with you. I want you to show me, you know, the stuff that you know, and I want to just be doing the exact same thing that you're doing each and every training session. And so that's what we did.
Exactly.
You know, and we slapped on 200 pounds on your total.
I had a unique opportunity during that time. I had time and I had the resources, and that's why I went down and I trained with Flex, because I wanted to be a pro bodybuilder. I wanted to train with the best, and I wanted to learn. So I trained with him every single day. I lived in an extended stay across from the gym, and we trained twice a day for 2 months straight.
And if so, those walls of the extended stay could talk.
Yes.
God damn.
I did the same thing when I wanted to be the best powerlifter I could be. I came over, and that's why I said to you, look, I want to train with you every day. I'm going to come to your gym.
I was like, I don't even work out.
You're going to watch a lift
or two. I got so scared.
But that was a unique opportunity. Nowadays, I think there's so many guys, so many great guys, who have posted so much content on the internet of their lifting and their philosophies. I think people can get a lot further than I could at the time.
Right.
Because I didn't have all that information you know, compiled for me.
Yeah, there's a lot more people. There's a lot more information coming from different angles now.
A ton of great information from great lifters.
Right.
And they're real forthcoming with it. I've always been real fortunate. The guys are very candid. And I've had an opportunity to travel around and train with a bunch of different guys. I went out and trained with Eddie Cohn in Chicago, and I went out and trained with Eric Lillibridge.
Ed Cohn, the greatest powerlifter of all time, without question.
Cool. Yep. We've had a lot of the guys up here to train with us. So, you know, the amazing amount you can learn now as compared to historically when we were starting out. You were telling a story this morning about you're at the gym doing your back work 20 years ago, and you had to ask Charles Glass about, you know, the form on one exercise. And it was the same way with me when I was coming up just bodybuilding. You know, the guy behind the counter at the Gold's Gym was your source of information.
Well, and the cool thing is Charles Glass, you know, who's a high-level trainer of some of the best bodybuilders ever, he shared information with me. He just came over and said, hey, you should try this way, which actually killed me. I shouldn't have asked him anything. Regretfully, he kicked my ass. But, you know, it's you know, once you came into the gym, though, and once we started posting up those videos and kind of showing people, like, you know, here's this high-level bodybuilder, this pro bodybuilder who's now doing powerlifting, I think people saw the combination of somebody being ripped, somebody being tan, somebody being vascular, somebody who's in really good shape hitting up these big weights. I think it was extremely motivational for a lot of people. And a lot of people started to try to embrace a similar philosophy with their training.
When you decided to go into powerlifting from bodybuilding or whatever, did you watch any videos? Because at that time, like, everybody was in gear. And a 2,000-pound total was pretty good, even in multiply gear. What made you say, like, I can do what those guys are doing with all this canvas, but I'm going to do it with just my fucking hamstrings?
I have to say I didn't. I was a novice to the industry. I didn't know anybody in the industry.
Right.
I didn't watch any videos up until the time I did that first meet with you.
Right.
It was after that time or about that time.
Then you started to study it more.
I started to study it more. I started to learn who the players were in the game. And again, like you mentioned, there was a resurgence around that time when we started posting our videos. We had the benefit of muscular development, and Flex Magazine at the time was doing a lot of coverage on me. So it drew in a lot more viewers because of that controversy with Johnny Jackson, et cetera, and because the bodybuilding community is more organized and more well-publicized.
Yeah.
So we had that added advantage of a lot of people started watching and seeing this going on, and it became interesting. And then a lot of kids started posting. And I say kids, I don't mean that disrespectfully, because there's a lot of, you know, Eric Liebridge started putting up
how old
videos.
How old are you?
And 47. And
just to put it in perspective, the reason why you said
young
kids.
Guys. Yeah. You know, all those guys that trained around and with Eric, right, and throughout the country. And you know, George Lehman started posting up some Savage,
yeah,
videos,
yeah,
around that same time.
Yeah.
You know, those crazy kids that are around Eric.
I remember right away, right off the bat, you were drawn to Eric Liebridge. I remember you were saying, like, this guy's coming. Like, he's my shit's gone.
Yeah.
My records are as good as being, you know, just destroyed. And I remember at the time thinking, fuck, man, I don't know, Stan. Like, you put up some pretty big numbers, but you're like, no, my records are they're gone. They're as good as gone.
Yeah,
I'm also,
yeah,
kissing him goodbye now, or just enjoying him for what, the
if
moment
you can't
I can.
See it by watching him lift, even a few years back, when I went out and trained with him, it became painfully obvious how good he was at lifting.
Right.
I've always been a hack. I came in here and I didn't know anything about technique.
Right.
You changed so many things. That,
right,
you know, that were so different just 6 months prior, 8 months prior, when I did that 2070.
Right.
I was doing a narrow stance squat.
Right.
And then we just switched to a wide stance. I went from a struggling with a 755 to hitting an easy 8.25,
right,
at the meet. And I'd hit that 850 if I hadn't torn my glute,
right,
on the first lift. But in the gym, we were hitting 800, doubling 800s, and
right,
that was something I'd never done before, just from making a minor adjustment in technique.
Right.
And technique, to me, was nothing that I ever focused on in terms of powerlifting.
Right.
Obviously, because I was just trying to lift heavy for bodybuilding.
Right. Did you, you know, for bodybuilding, what made you want to lift heavy? Were you just trying to get bigger? Like, what was the – because not a lot of bodybuilders lift super heavy.
Yeah, I always had that mindset. The more weight I could lift, the bigger I would get. I learned late.
Right, right.
And I was young and dumb, and again, that was almost
– You need a little bit of that, though. I mean, you're huge now, but, you know, there's guys like Kai Greene who preach about lifting less weight. But then again, you'll also see Kai Greene, you know.
Still benches 500.
Yeah, he'll still bench 500. He'll handle a 455 for a few reps on incline and stuff. So you need to overload. You need to stimulate the muscles with heavy weight. Don't you agree?
Well, I think there's a density that you obtain and acquire for your physique from that,
right,
kind of lifting. A certain density like Ronnie has, that sinewy, fibrous kind of
dense, yeah,
muscle tissue that looks so good on stage, a hardness.
He just looks like he could rip off someone's head.
Yeah. I trained with Phil Hernon way back when, and he would, you know, he'd watch people come in the gym, and he could tell you whether or not they were headed to a free bar exercise or to a machine.
Right.
Just by looking at their physique.
Wow.
Wow.
So there's a certain sort of density in the physique from guys that squat and bench and
right,
do, yeah, those movements. The higher repetition stuff's great for volume.
What do you think of my physique?
Well, I mean, it's...
It's very doughy.
It needs some work. I'm no pro, but I know it needs some work.
Never mind.
Yes, kind of on that same topic, around what year did you start lifting, and like, kind of who did you look up to? Because in the 90s, you know, I don't know that much history. I'm a little bit
younger.
We're
talking about the 70s, Mike.
Okay, in the 60s, there was a lot of machines going on.
It was 85. Yeah,
yeah, but in the 80s and early 90s, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's... kind of a resurgence or a trend of everybody lifting on machines and pec decks and cables and all this. And then it seemed a little bit before that, obviously Arnold and stuff, everybody was more into barbells. And then now it seems like there's a resurgence of barbells. Like we just said, like Kai Greene and these guys are mashing huge benches and even deadlifts. Where did you begin? And did you always kind of train with the main three lifts or a barbell lift?
You know, originally I started training with the barbell lifts, but back then there wasn't the internet, so all you had was the videos and pictorials.
No internet, Mike.
None. I don't understand.
So the pictorials that came out were it was Flex and Charles and Chris Cormier down there, and that was Flex was probably putting out the most videos at the time,
right?
And so you'd watch those videos, and those guys were lifting pretty big weights, you know, particularly for the camera.
Right.
Behind the scenes, you find out later that there's a lot more volume going on.
Right.
But,
yeah. A lot more reps and sets.
Yeah. You didn't know that.
Is it standard for most, you know, most of the bodybuilders, you know, when you were getting into it, to kind of use more machines, or were they kind of more into free weights, or did you see kind of a mix?
You know, it was a lot of machines.
Right.
It was a lot of machines. And I did a little bit of everything. I think that's one of the biggest reasons that I was able to be successful in powerlifting is because I'd spent so many years working at from such a variety of angles.
You hit it from the back.
And rep range.
And the side.
And
the front.
Yes, and volume. It's a long time. And when I was working on all those exercises, I think I didn't have any weaknesses. And you know, that's what even now, you know, a lot of great coaches will try and find out where you're weakest and then work on that.
Right. I remember when you were working on your deadlift and you kind of you were having a little bit of trouble using your legs, getting your legs kind of engaged, you know, into the lift. And I remember making a suggestion to you of doing like some leg presses and some deadlifts, kind of back and forth to get the feel for it. Because really, like I remember talking to Cone, he said a deadlift, if you get it right, should kind of feel like a leg press.
Yep.
You know, so you've done like those kind of movements to kind of help correct, but you've also done, I mean, using movements like a hack squat, using movements like even a leg extension, leg press, all these different movements, hitting things from all these different angles has allowed you to hit these big weights in powerlifting with a barbell.
And even allowing you to build more hypertrophy so that, you know, a bigger muscle can become a stronger muscle. So at some point in powerlifting, if you're not overly concerned with your weight class all the time, it always benefits to do a lot of hypertrophy exercise.
Right.
Eddie Cohn was big on that. He only competed twice a year.
Right.
Then he'd deload and he'd spend a number of months doing hypertrophy training. He'd do more repetitions.
And his physique kind of showed it too.
Yeah.
A lot of those guys.
Yeah, they were jacked.
Yeah,
where did
jacked.
He start? 165 and ended up at 242.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I mean, that's evidence unto itself about how much muscle mass he put on all over those years.
Right.
And he didn't do that by doing singles every week.
Right.
You know, Eddie was famous for picking some sort of supporting exercise and hammering that out for PRs in the gym, whether it was behind the neck press or he would even do one-legged leg presses.
Right.
Right.
You mentioned the internet a couple times. How many hours a day do you spend on Instagram scrolling through all the different butt shots of all the ladies?
I think I only have you and Mike O'Hearn on my Instagram so far. I'm late
you're
to the
learning.
Table on that.
You're learning.
I don't have very many people on that.
Well, me and Mike will show you. It'll blow your mind.
Yeah. The two gayest people I knew, I put them on my Instagram.
Yeah. Now you're screwed.
Yeah.
All you see is pictures of our abs and Michael Hearn's dog.
Yeah.
You're like, what the fuck is this for again?
There's hidden gems in there. You'll find them.
Yeah. There's hidden gems everywhere.
Yeah, it's just like which icon is it? It's the search one?
The explore button.
The explore button. Yeah.
There's a button made for
that. That's where all the perversion goes on.
Yeah. It's based on what you liked. So if you liked a bunch of bikini girls, you click this explore button and it's just women.
Just all butts.
Yeah,
basically. It's just all ass.
Yeah, the fitness in terms of YouTube is a very small percentage of what's going on YouTube.
Right.
There's like tech stuff and car stuff. But on Instagram,
gaming.
I think fitness is a large percentage of what's going on.
You're right. Well, there's so many women on Instagram.
Yeah.
Just huge female population on Instagram.
Hot women.
You know, I was going to say, we're going back to those original videos. I think if we were putting those out brand new like 6 months ago, they would be so much bigger than they were at the time. And at the time, they were big.
Ten times the amount, I'd imagine.
You'd show more ass shots. And we'd
that
get more,
too.
More popularity.
Yeah, things got a little weird last night.
You set a world record.
Hey, now.
You get 300 viewers, but if you show your butt in a G-string, you get 30,000.
I
don't see what's wrong with that.
Or, I mean, for example, if we showed you eating, if we showed you, like, if you're like, oh, this is a normal, you know, post-workout meal that I eat, that might have more views than you squat 900 pounds.
Yeah.
It's
fucking weird. You can't really tell what people are going to gravitate towards.
Yeah.
Well, YouTube is TV now. That's
right.
The thing. And so all those weird trends that we see in regular, you know, cable and network TV.
All the reality stuff.
Yeah, that comes around to YouTube pretty quickly now.
YouTube's the real reality TV with no script.
Right.
Can we talk about the women that you used to bring into the gym back in the day, or we shouldn't talk about that?
No.
Okay, never mind. All right, next question.
What's your lifting and eating like now? It looks like you've maintained a lot of muscle and slimmed down a little bit. But
I used to hang out around 285 or so, and so as soon as I got done with that last powerlifting meet, it's exhausting to be at for me, that was a heavy weight.
Right.
And you're just tired all the time, you know, trying to powerlift, plus the loads and what they do to your central nervous system. So, you know, as soon as that last meet was over, the 2303 total, I lost almost 40 pounds in 40 days.
Jesus.
I just pulled carbs out of my diet and started sprinting, which was really pathetic looking initially. Actually, I will admit I was just walking initially. And just getting up in the morning and taking a walk.
But you were thinking really fast.
Yeah. And eventually I worked into doing some HIIT training, and then I could only do things that didn't hurt for a while because I had, you know, I had hip impingement, I had shoulder impingement. I had a lot of elbow tendonitis.
Right.
I'd acquired some bumps and bruises along the way. I was well past my window of opportunity to be doing those kinds of lifts at 45 years old. So,
what style of HIIT training were you doing? Like, what did that?
Well, I do some low impact stuff. So I was either sprinting stairs, which tends to be pretty low impact for the body, and as compared to just straight sprints. And I was doing you know, like a recumbent bike with some resistance work, and maybe 20 seconds under tension, and then rest for a minute.
A hill sprint or stairs is going to be a better option, especially for bigger guys, than just going out and trying to sprint, right?
Stairs even better. Hill sprints, one of the problems you get is Achilles tendon stretch.
Right.
But sprinting in and of itself, just on a flat track, you got all kinds of problems.
Yeah,
you got
hammies and hips and stuff.
Well, every time you land on your leg, you're getting that.
Right. It's like, what, 12 times the amount of your body weight or some shit like that, the forces, right?
Something that eccentric load. You're breaking down muscle tissue. It's when you run on stairs, of course, it's all concentric, so you have less delayed onset muscle soreness. You can use it more as a active recovery sort of benefits. You
right.
can train in the gym, and then the next day or the day after, you can go do some HIIT training, and it can complement you instead of breaking you
right.
down.
Somebody that wants to start this up, that's listening to this, what would you suggest? Somebody who's just, let's just say they're pretty out of shape, and they want to start to implement some of this HIIT training, what would you suggest as a progression?
Well, initially, I just... I would sprint the stairs, and then I would walk down, and I would use my timer and kind of feel as how long did it take me to get to where I think I could do that again.
Right.
I wasn't trying to push myself into a 1 minute rest or a 45 second rest. Yeah. Initially, that was like 3 minutes.
Right.
I would stay up, sit there, gasping.
And research shows that you can rest pretty much as long as you want. Doesn't it show some of that?
Yeah.
You can rest like 6 minutes or so in terms of burning calories and burning body fat, right?
Here's the thing. You get off the couch and walk, and that's progression. And you get results from that.
Right.
So if you run up the stairs and it takes you 5 minutes to recover before you do another set, that's progression when you knock it down to 4.5 minutes.
Right.
4 minutes. And right. so you don't prescribe a particular starting point. You let the individual tell you what is more than what they did yesterday.
Right.
And the worst thing you can do is come out of the gates at 100%, because then where do you go from there?
You need to tear something or hurt something, yeah.
Yeah, it's all progression. Any even minimal increase in improvement in performance, and that's whether you increase the load, the speed, the reps, the volume per hour, reduce the rest periods, increase the number of HIIT intervals.
Right.
There's so many different variables that you can slowly start to improve over time that'll yield a result. And I work now with a lot of people who are, all they're trying to do is get in shape.
Right.
They're not, I work with, working with IFBB pros for bodybuilding, work with professional powerlifters, sure. But most of the interest comes from people that are just trying to lose some body fat.
Right.
My business partner's one. Not a single man in his family's ever lived out of their 50s. He's 45 years old.
That's discouraging.
5'8", 290 pounds.
Wow.
And he says, I got to get back in shape. He played college football at 230 as a fullback. So he just came down to Vegas and stayed for a month in Vegas. And he went from 292 to he was 268 yesterday when he weighed in.
That's some fucking progress for you right there.
And it was a simple program. I said, we're just going to move.
Right.
We're just going to move every day. And initially, we pulled out carbs, and we just went on a 2,000-calorie-a-day diet. So it's 400 or 500-calorie meals. And the specifics of that meal really don't matter. Dr. Lane Norton talked in his research about clean eating versus if it fits your macros. You may have read that article.
Yeah.
And really, it doesn't matter. It
doesn't matter a ton.
The dominating factor is calories in, calories out.
Right? Yeah, then you can break it down in priority.
Beyond that, you can start prioritizing your macros. But what we did with him is pulled out, initially, he's African-American, and he's 290 pounds. He's got type 2 diabetes.
Right.
And that's a huge problem. So immediately you want to start increasing exercise and decreasing carbohydrate intake to try and get that,
Switch, yeah.
With all that, like keto or low-carb, do you have any kind of, refeed or anything weird with, I don't know that much about, diabetics or is there something you have to do with insulin? Does he have to have rice every 2 weeks or anything to stay weird or not get faint or...
No, not necessarily. And there's varying degrees of type 2, type 1, type 2 obviously being different. There's very differing degrees of type 2 diabetes and how it affects you in terms of your energy levels and your blood sugars. And, one of the things I'll do is initially I'll just pull carbs and it makes it easy for them to make decisions.
Right.
And then eventually after, a couple of weeks, everything only has about a 3 to 5 week lifespan in terms of if it's benefit for results, really. Then you got to start trying to tweak it, increase the workload.
Something's got to change, right?
Something's got to change. You got to keep
at least a little bit
in your body, and then we'll just do post workout carbs for him.
Oh, perfect.
He can only eat carbs after he trains. He's getting 50 grams of carbs, and you feel good, and that's been very effective for.
Is he insulin dependent? I didn't get
type two. Type two, yeah. It's non-insulin-dependent diabetes.
You mentioned you put him on like 2,000 calories or whatever and broke it up into calories per meal. Do you just have him track it on like an app or something like that?
Or just tracks it on an app. And then what I do is I try and find out, rather than anytime you prescribe somebody a diet, they're destined for failure because you're picking foods maybe that they don't historically eat, that aren't convenient for
them.
They don't taste good to them. So I try and find out, what do you eat? You tell me what you eat. You tell me where you eat. You tell me when you eat. Mm-hmm. And then I'll just teach them how to navigate those waters.
More of this, less of that.
Yeah, my business partner travels a lot. He's on an airplane flying around. And so I got to teach him how to eat at fast food places from time to time, or at airports, or you know, whenever he can grab a meal, and show him what to select. And here's about what 500 calories looks like, and here's the meal choices you can have.
You know, I remember you telling me before, you know, like with something like fast food, even if you have a protein shake with that fast food, it helps to augment the meal.
Yeah.
It helps make the meal, I guess, better, basically, you know, because you're adding protein and there's no fat in it or anything like that in it.
Yeah, and I'm not even afraid of fat so much as total calorie count. I mean, he was eating two pieces of bacon and two whole eggs for breakfast. You know,
right.
You wouldn't think, you put somebody on a diet, you wouldn't think that would be a plan for a diet.
Right. Right.
But total calories is the primary concern. Carbohydrates was the secondary concern. And then over time, as we get him down, we can make some, you know, some alternate changes.
And you're just trying to improve his quality of life. You're not trying to get him ready for a stage somewhere. It's a different thing. And I don't know. People want to take those diets that are made for people who are going to compete in something and turn them into their own personal thing, so they think they'll have the greatest selfie in the world, and that this, you know, it's silly.
No, it is, and plus, to reach that level, it there's such a big sacrifice in terms of time, you know, and quality of life.
Right.
Again, because I call it, you become a victim of your own circumstance when you compete at an elite level. Now there's certain things you can't do. There's so much time you have to invest into your training, into your nutrition, and the type of nutrition. You just become, you know,
and you can't go backwards. That's the thing. It's like once you do a 606 bench, you got to try to do more, right? I mean, fuck, now you're screwed.
It's all about PRs.
Yeah. I can just claim old age and tell people to Google me.
Now you got, as I remember before that, the last two meets, some discouraging news about like a hip. Or something?
Yeah, even prior to that, I had some really bad hip impingement. I was tearing labrum in my hip because the hip bone was grinding in that sumo position. So I went to part of it was flexibility. You know, IT band was tight, TFL. You know, the glute medius, everything was torquing on that hip in such a way that it wouldn't allow it to rotate inside the socket without impinging and tearing labrum. And so I went to Mark Phillippe down there.
Right.
He was former head strength coach at UNLV, and he used to train with Eddie.
Former world's strongest man competitor also.
Yeah, yeah. He's got a hell of a
history. And a good powerlifter.
And a great coach. And so I went to him, and we started training twice a week doing a whole bunch of mobility exercises. And that's on YouTube, Understand Efforting Mobility. You can see everything that we did. And
we'll link that to this show.
You know, I've passed it along to a lot of top powerlifters over the last couple of years who've had enormous success with it. It's people talk about how hard they work in the gym, but that's really only a small part of what it takes to be successful, a very small part.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't have the discipline to maintain your health, both in terms of meals, sleep, mobility, flexibility, and all of that, I don't think you can make it to the very top level. I just don't think you can
do it. Yeah, and even if you do make it to the very top level, maybe that's because of genetics or whatever, but you're still not reaching your potential.
Yeah.
You're not reaching your maximum potential.
That's true.
When you were trying to set world records and also chasing after a dream of becoming a professional bodybuilder, you know, what time did you wake up in the morning, and like what was your typical day like? Like, let's say when you were training with Flex Wheeler to become pro, what was a typical day like for you? What time did it start?
Yeah, we'd wake up early and get a meal in.
What's early?
At 6 a.m. or 5:30. I tried not to set an alarm to wake myself up. I wanted to wake up naturally.
Make sure you have rest, yeah.
Yep, I believe in the sleep cycles and the REM sleep, and I don't want to pull myself out of that. And so I was just prepared when I woke up in the morning, whether it be 5:30, 6:30 a.m., I'd eat a meal and I'd go back to bed.
Right.
And then 2 hours later, I'd get up and I'd be on my second meal already by 8 a.m. And then, you know, Flex and I would usually train about 11 o'clock in the morning for an hour. It was just a blitz for an hour. We didn't have these long sessions. It was about, you know, double splitting. So we were putting more intensity into a shorter period of time and then shooting for volume per hour. This is a bodybuilding plan. And, you know, immediately after that, we'd eat and then nap again.
Wasn't he having you do like 10 sets of 10 or something like that in the morning and 10 sets of 10 at night or something like that?
Well, I mean, we'd split the parts, just say push, right, pull legs. And we'd, you know, on a push day, you just come in the morning, do chest, and at night, do shoulders and triceps. And the next day on a pull day, you might come in the morning, do back, and at night, do biceps. And on a legs day, you come in the morning, do quads, and at night, do hamstrings. Right. So it's push, pull legs.
You just take one day off and then kind of repeat it?
We were going six straight. And, yeah, and it really just depends on how good is your recovery. How good is your cardiovascular system, which is huge for recovery, so you kind of have to be prepared for those kinds of things or build into them. Initially, I might put somebody on a 2-on-1-off and try and build them into a 3-on-1-off and then try and build them into a 6-straight. But it's a progression because you can't start out that way.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, utilize that kind of volume with those kind of short rest periods as much as you want until you adapt to it.
Right.
So it all becomes a progression. I'm working with some pros right now, and initially when you take them through a workout, they're gassed such that their strength starts to tank because,
right,
oxygen debt becomes a limiting factor. And you kind of got to get them conditioned.
This general fitness level needs to come up.
Yep, absolutely. And once you do that, then you find out that you know, once your fitness level comes up, you find out you recover faster from workouts.
Right.
Your blood volume, your red blood cell count increases. Your body becomes more efficient. And now you can train more often with more,
right,
volume, which is a huge benefit to you. If you can increase that frequency and volume and still recover from it, you can only train.
Do you think one of these CrossFitters would have potential to be a great bodybuilder due to their fitness level, like someone like Rich Froning?
Oh, I think he'd be extraordinary at it. And here's the thing: is now you got to send the right message. And this is a conversation that can fall over into powerlifting. There's different messages. You know, a lot of times those guys will do a lot of cardio, and immediately I'll pull that back,
right?
Because you want the body, if you're trying to build hypertrophy, You can't go out and do 40 minutes on a treadmill.
Right.
It sends the wrong message. Your body's going to respond to the stimulus that you provide.
Right.
But you do want to keep your cardiovascular fitness up. You do want to keep your ability to elevate your heart rate, you know, really high.
Right.
And you want to be able to have a good blood volume and a high red blood cell count. You want to be able to recover from workouts. And so you can do that with the HIIT training, which is why I suggested that. And even then, you don't even need the HIIT training if you're doing 2-a-day bodybuilding workouts with that amount of volume in those shorter rest periods.
Right.
Because your heart rate's 160 beats a minute between sets anyhow.
Right.
So, you know, to me, it's a matter of messaging. And I say this over and over to an elite bodybuilder or powerlifter that's peaking or trying to compete in their sport at a high level, is you need to stop doing things that aren't going to benefit your goal, that aren't,
right,
sending the right message. You want your body to adapt to one message. And don't confuse it.
Right.
Quit pulling yourself in both directions.
But maybe in an off-season type of setting, maybe you do want to do some of those things.
Well, yeah, now we're talking about what's your long-term plan. Even,
right,
Olympic lifters, we were talking yesterday about Klokov. We were,
right,
about,
yeah.
He did a lot of cardio in the off-season. Now, he had a one-year plan.
Right.
Or maybe even longer.
Yeah.
Where he would spend...
They sometimes have an Olympic training plan, which is 4 years.
Yes. And part of that plan, we mentioned Eddie Cohn earlier, who would deload and then do hypertrophy training and then start, you know, getting into his progression for powerlifting. You have a plan that's bigger than the 8 or 10 weeks that you're prepping for a powerlifting,
right,
meet, or the 8 or 10 weeks that you're prepping for a bodybuilding show. You have a plan that goes back 8-9 months. When I trained with Flex, one of the first things he did is when I was back home in Seattle... He threw me a starter up diet. He says, "Here's what I want you to eat." And I said, "Well, how much?" And he goes, "Well, as much as you can initially, and here's kind of a sample." And so we,
right,
do 6 ounces of meat, a cup of rice, 5 meals a day. That's just an example. And he says, "How are you doing with that? Can you eat that?" I said, "Yeah, it's okay. I'm kind of full." He says, "Well, call me back in 10 days. And 10 days later, I call him back, and he says, "Okay, let's go to 8 ounces of meat, a cup and a half of rice, 5 meals.
Right.
10 days later, I call him back. I'm hungry again. He goes, "Okay, we'll go to 10 ounces of meat, a cup and a half of rice, 6 meals.
Wow.
And there was a progression like
that's
that.
That's a lot of fucking food.
And I think, again, if you've read Dr. Lane Norton's stuff, he talks about reverse dieting.
Right.
And that's exactly what it was. You know,
right.
We had to train our metabolism the same way you train your strength.
Yeah, build, right, your work capacity, build your appetite, build,
exactly,
your calorie.
Exactly. You can't go into the gym if you're a 315 bencher and load 405 on the bar and say, "Give me a lift off."
I remember at a seminar that we did with Jesse Burdick up in Washington, you came to the seminar and you spoke about nutrition. And you kind of talked about fueling your body, you know, over time and kind of this almost reverse dieting type of system. And you kind of said, like, you know, then you become like a slave to your own body.
Oh, yeah.
And you're just constantly thinking about your nutrition. You're constantly thinking about the next meal. And then you also said something to the effect of like, and then you're constantly like, sweating and you're constantly going to the bathroom and you're constantly.
Yeah.
So it entails all these other things that you don't really think about. You know, your body becomes like a furnace.
You turn yourself into a more efficient machine that can right. do more faster. The faster you can recover, the more food you can metabolize. And that's the point of this part of the conversation is the more food you can metabolize becomes – that's a progressive component.
Right.
And if you're eating 3,000 calories a day and you're able to maintain your weight, well, after you've trained your metabolism to eat 5,000 calories a day, if you go back to 3,000 calories, you're going to lose weight like crazy.
Right.
Yeah. And it seems odd, but the fact is that your body becomes a more efficient machine, mm-hmm. a furnace. Now it can fuel those huge workouts.
Yeah, recover a little
You don't
better.
Really like to eat that much, right?
I'm not a big fan of it,
right?
Because you know the frequency, like with Flex, has to
like
eat
if you had it your way,
day.
You'd eat like three or four times a day, probably.
Yep, it's a little more convenient. And I've talked to a lot of pros that opt to stay.
I remember hearing Jay Cutler talk about it. He's like, I hate it.
Yeah,
I hate
and
it.
And that was going to be my example. They would prefer to stay within a range that they could, you know, fuel.
Yeah, manage a little easier.
Yeah, and that's the hardest part about. All of this competing is, for me, was always the nutrition.
Do you think it's important for, you know, all athletes kind of embrace this style of eating where you're, you know, trying to fuel yourself more, you're trying to really force nutrition to force recovery in terms of like CrossFit, bodybuilding, powerlifting, football, just any sport basically?
Well, I think anytime your workload demands more nutrition, then you're going to have to train your metabolism to provide it more nutrition. But you look at we were just talking about Rich Froning. I mean, he was, sucking on gallons of whole milk every
yeah.
day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and eating Oreos.
Eating cookies.
Yeah. Yeah, and because he, you know, he couldn't eat a lot of meals because he was training three times a day. He didn't need to be
right.
digesting all the time, and he kind of catch up with meals at night. But, whole milk's a perfect example of a very nutrient-dense, high-calorie.
Right.
A gallon of whole milk's 2,500 calories. So
I remember I was at your house. You had that crock pot full of tri-tip and potatoes, and can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, there always had to be some, you had to prepare in advance because if you start every time you start to cook a meal, if it takes you 20 minutes,
right.
half hour, and then
yeah, if you don't plan ahead, you plan to fail, right?
Yeah, 45 minutes later, you're prepping your next meal. I remember I was in Samoa visiting my wife's family back there, and they started what they call a traditional umu. And it's they heat up.
Sounds some, delicious already.
Yes.
Count me in. Sounds fatty.
Well, they have all the food on their own land. They'll raise pigs. They'll raise chicken. They'll have taro, potato. They'll have bananas, pineapples. So they go around. When it comes time to eat, they run around. They behead a chicken, and they'll cut up a pig, and they'll cook it all right there. Well, this process takes hours.
Right.
And I'm standing back. And of course, I'm sweating like crazy. It's humid. It's humid, and I'm looking around, and I'm already in my mind. I'm doing the math, and I'm like, okay, now we've got to heat up these rocks. We've got to wrap this food in here. It's going to take about 2 hours to cook, and then we're going to eat. And then what do I do after that?
Yeah.
Because I got to eat every 3 hours.
Put it in your pocket.
Yeah. And these guys will eat twice a day, but they'll eat for extended period of time, and
right.
it's kind of a high fatty meal. But they're,
right.
I don't. My metabolism isn't like that. I don't. I'll start burning my body up like crazy.
Right.
I can't sit on one meal. And so that's the whole gist of the whole thing is that you got to be prepared. You got to. So I have my food pre-cooked, like you said. I'll either grill up a bunch of steaks in the morning, or I'll have a tri-tip going. And it's always calorie-dense food. I could never eat enough chicken to maintain or build body mass.
Right.
And that's a personal thing, right?
Yeah.
On your metabolism and build. And
It is. Some people tend, endomorphs, mesomorphs, they tend to do better with chicken. Ectomorphs, good luck to you because you need a lot more calories.
Right.
You need a lot more fat. I'm a big fan of the cholesterol-based animal fats, the red meats, just because I think that, the cholesterol is such a huge component to having a nutrient dense diet.
Right.
And it's not getting a bad rap anymore.
No, finally. It's almost like vindication. I used to try and tell athletes to switch to red meats, and they would look at me like I was crazy. But that was one of the big things we did with Flex many years ago, and I was eating probably 4 pounds of steak a day on his program.
They say look at the size of a neck of a bull versus the size of a neck of a chicken.
Yeah.
Which one do you rather look like?
Or have you ever seen a big chicken?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Going back,
that's true.
Going back to kind of the internet, you know, there's been like little cults now, and there's a split. You know, there's this if it fits your macros group, which is flexible dieting, in my opinion, because mm-hmm. if it fits your macros, like everything else, takes things overboard, and people sure. think you're eating cake all day long or whatever. Sure. And then there's the other guys that say all you can eat is spinach and tilapia 24/7. Right. And obviously, these are both. Polar opposites, and there's probably the answers down the middle somewhere. But you already mentioned that you are more of a proponent of kind of if it fit your macros or flexible dieting, where calories, you know, in the scheme of things are most important, and then second maybe the macronutrient breakdown, and then third maybe food choices themselves. Yep. You know, everybody I think in the world would agree that a potato and broccoli is going to give you more micronutrients and a little bit healthier than eating cake all day long, even if the carbohydrates are the same grams. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And I think it's interesting because you're a very top level athlete in both powerlifting and IFBB. Some of your mentors are Mark and Flex, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And when you said you were kind of reverse dieting with Flex, he was doing that, but he was calculating your calories, so you didn't have to think about it, correct?
Yeah. And this was reverse dieting before it was called reverse right. dieting. I mean, Flex has been doing this for 20 years.
Yeah.
And this was, you know, if it fits your macros before it was called if it fits your macros.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of the thing when I talk about some of these concepts is just because they've had a label put on them more recently. They create the debate and they become internet, you know, fodder.
Branding and yeah, yeah. all that.
All that stuff. But, you know, really we just tried to focus on what worked and I tried to look at the people who it worked right. the best for.
And everybody, it's bro science, but
right.
but it's, you know, your body's the lab. And
yeah, now you mentioned if it fits your macros versus clean eating, and you said something about potato and broccoli being more micronutrient dense. There's more nutrient density in bacon and steak than in any vegetable or potato.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. I was just comparing it to like Pop-Tarts or the typical.
I got
yeah,
you.
Yeah,
yeah, I just yeah. want to make sure we make the
yeah,
distinction.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
I agree. Because I really focus on nutrient density. When I tell people to eat steak, I tell them to eat steak because it has so much more in it than white meat.
Yeah,
such
they got
as
magnesium
chicken or fish.
And yeah,
creatine
going on.
And B yeah. vitamins and iron. And I mean, you can build a great athlete on those nutrients.
Yeah.
And you have to eat less of them.
Right.
You know, I would say, particularly with respect to steak, you know, and if it's grass-fed, even better, is that, you know, people ask me about salads, and I said, salad, that's what my food eats.
Right, right, right.
And then it's all ready for me. You know,
right,
I've been
right.
doing it for years.
yeah,
they've compiled it and put it in this very nutrient-dense, bioavailable format for me to consume and get, you know, all of these.
Yeah, they got rid of all the junk already.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think about vegetables? And, I mean, you're mentioning it kind of in a lighthearted way, but like in terms of just overall health, you know, is fiber important? And are vegetables, do they have their place other than just filling your stomach with non-caloric dense food? Do they have any other value?
Well, you know, I look at Chad Nichols, who coached both Flex Wheeler and Ronnie Coleman, and he never put a vegetable in Ronnie Coleman's diet.
Right.
And Ronnie was the biggest freak on the planet. And so do I think they're 100%
I don't like vegetables, so I don't eat them. That's what he said.
Yeah.
Some say that in a seminar.
Although I would like to see a healthy body,
right.
I think overall leads to a healthier athlete. But then now you have to prioritize what's going to actually build and repair muscle better and faster.
It's hard to distinguish what's healthy.
That's true.
And healthy for what? That's the other issue, too. I mean, the thing I get hit on all the time with my wife, who practically has a degree in nutrition as well.
Your
as
wife
nursing.
Hits on me, too.
Yeah, I know. It sucks. I can't keep her under control.
Your wife's a nurse, we should say.
Yeah, she's a nurse. But she talks about the foods that we consider nutrient dense that are from the vegetable world, yams and sweet potatoes, squash, cruciferous vegetables, things like that. They have things that we haven't figured out what they do yet, but we think they're good for us.
Right, right. There's
that's
a lot
what
of
it,
that.
That's what it comes down
well,
to.
Well, I should back out of the equation here and mention that nothing that we do at this table is healthy. Nothing that yeah, anybody
right.
who competes at an elite level, and
right.
I don't care whether it's look at all the marathon runners that drop in their 50s.
Yeah, right.
You know, from enlarged heart. And then you've got bodybuilders, powerlifters, CrossFitters. I mean, talk about taking your body to a place
yeah.
that
right.
it's unhealthy.
Well, moderation's healthy, right?
Yeah,
so
well,
sure.
Jog
not,
a little bit, lift a little bit,
so
you'll be healthy.
Who are you prescribing this for?
Yeah,
you're prescribing
right.
it for your mom who just needs to, you know, be fit?
Yeah.
Or are you talking about an elite athlete? And so I have to be very careful to make that distinction because when I suggest a nutrient program for an elite athlete, it's going to err on the side of performance.
Right.
Always. So I will say this in terms of vegetables. I do try and get some steamed vegetables in. I don't like to eat uncooked vegetables. I think it's absolutely shown in science to decrease the amount of protein that's absorbed from the protein that you consume. It leaches valuable nutrients from the body, such as minerals and electrolytes, magnesium and iron, zinc. So I don't try and overload myself with lots of veggies. And when I train, say, bikini and figure girls for competition, I'll immediately change them.
Hey, now.
Yeah, I can coach. Do you need an assistant?
Yeah.
What you need?
We'll have you guys come in for posing.
Yeah, that sounds great.
But they look at me crazy when I pull the white meat out and I'll put in a couple pieces of bacon for breakfast. Because they've restricted themselves so much that they put themselves.
You
they
like
start
giving the bikini girls more meat,
more meat, more bacon.
Every bikini girl needs more meat.
Yes, that's first
noted.
Thing I don't.
That's this a t-shirt.
Won't cost you a thing. It's just a sausage.
Just but, giving them some tips.
Yeah. And I don't know if I'm getting too far off track here, but the point is that people when they undergo restriction. Eating egg whites and chicken breasts and tilapia and stuff like that. They're losing out on so many valuable things. Iron, half the athletes.
You're losing out. I like that.
half the athletes that go to the Olympic Training Center in Denver, they get a blood test. They find out they're iron deficient.
Right.
They train, at such a high level that they need more of these nutrients. Do you take it with a supplement or do you get it with red meat? Not always opt for red meat.
Right.
Sodium is another huge factor. When people go on these restrictive diets, be it egg whites and chicken, et cetera, sodium's a huge performance enhancer. It's one of the first things I added in with when I was working with Dan Green. He said he was getting tired from his workouts because of his diet, and he'd go to Carl's Jr. afterwards and said he felt so much better once he got those carbs in. I said, it's not the carbs.
It's the salt.
It's the salt.
Yeah.
You're in there sweating and working as hard as you work. Sodium's a huge performance enhancer, and so we'll try and put some more of that back into the diet, and their performance increases.
Carl's Jr. increases your deadlift, you think?
I think so. I think it's good for
double
it.
Bacon, Western bacon. Yeah.
Do you remember when first aid kits used to come with salt tablets for people who worked in hot environments?
People don't understand how valuable, and the government has demonized it, and it's such a shame.
So what do you suggest? Such a small percentage of people who are actually sensitive to sodium in that way.
And it's a very small percentage, and even showing that these new guidelines are counterproductive. They're causing more problems. There seems to be you can get too low and you can get too high. But as an athlete, what's too high? Your body doesn't have a mechanism to store sodium. So you need to consume it to utilize it. Now, how much are you using? How much are you sweating? And how much do you replace? Runners know this. They take salt tablets. They get they have salt in their performance drinks. I remember everybody was talking about when LeBron James cramped up, they were all talking about the Gatorade or whatever else.
Right.
Well, there's hardly any sodium in those drinks.
Right.
If there were enough sodium in them, you couldn't taste them.
Well,
you
remember
couldn't
the,
drink them. They wouldn't
the meat
be
that we had that you nearly died at, where you had that cramp. And,
yeah.
And it was you were cramping so severely that you kind of thought you were done.
Yeah.
And we got you some Noon tablets. Remember that?
Yep.
Yeah, that made a big difference. And there's nothing overly insanely special about those tablets other than the fact that they have some micronutrients in them. They have some
they taste pretty good.
Sodium, some potassium. They got a little bit of vitamin in them and stuff like that.
Unless you work for Noon and you'd like to sponsor this podcast, in which case there's something exceptional about them.
But the point being is that sodium
tastes good.
That was the biggest
the
biggest performance problem in terms of cramping would come from the salt.
Right.
So that's something I added back into everybody's
Well, I remember on that day specifically, you were saying you drank a lot of water.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, shit.
Well,
you know, water dehydrates
you.
Yeah, it pulls everything out of you. So.
And I'd also that morning, and against my own recommendations, when I do water depletes and reloads for powerlifters who have weight classes and MMA fighters, one of the things that I make sure and do is get them to take sodium in with the water that they drink so that they're not dehydrating themselves. And I won't let them take in any sugar. Sugar stimulates the kidneys to release water again. Same problem.
Yeah.
Now you've got people generally after weigh-ins are trying to consume an enormous amount of sugar. They think it's quick carbohydrates.
Right.
But it causes problems with their water system. So I'll get them to take in sodium and eat lots of white rice, take in a little bit of fructose because your liver's depleted and that's your brain glycogen. So in order to get their energy levels back up, get their carbohydrates restored, get their water fluids back up, we took Dan from, everybody all heard over the internet.
Yeah.
It was at 320 pounds down to 220. and back up, like that. And back up to 360. Yeah. No, but typically he would drop 25 pounds.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes a little more, 28 right. pounds. Within 24
hours. He's still able to break world records.
On. Yeah. Well, and the key to that is that we drop it within 24 hours.
Right.
So he's not depleting himself a week prior.
Right.
You know.
You have crazy years of experience in all these strength sports, training different athletes. And then you competed, obviously, a few years ago. But you also stay up to date with all the newest articles and newest mm-hmm. everything else. What's some of the difference in terms of supplements that maybe you took back in the day or maybe what you take and prescribe now? Have you eliminated some products? Have you added some products? What are some supplements that you recommend now?
You know, back in the day, most of the supplements were loaded with sugar. They were weight gain powders. And me as an ectomorph, that was always, you know, weight gain. And they were loaded with sugar. Nowadays, you can get good supplements that aren't loaded with sugar. I'm not sponsored by anybody, so I'm not obligated to say anything nice about sports supplements. But, it's just a matter of choice. It's a supplement, and I try and do what gives you the greatest benefit, and that's right. eating food.
Yeah.
If you cannot eat the food, then you may need to, throw in a supplement. But somebody starting a program out asked me, you know, what protein powder should I get? Well, food
right.
is what protein powder you should get right. is food. But they think that that's somehow.
Well, you want to send a message even more so than just that. You want to send a message to them. Prepare your food. You know, wake up on time. Make sure you're eating, five or six meals a day. Like,
yeah.
It's a bigger message than just saying, you know, change your protein powder for food.
Yeah.
It's a larger message in saying you need to go to the store and load up on steak.
Well, it's the easy way,
you
right?
You need to cook steak.
People want to go to prepared. GNC. They want to go to GNC and buy their Progress or buy their. And right. you can.
Everything about the fitness industry over the last 30-plus years has been about making things easier on
right.
people.
Yeah, the slingshot and helps you bench press and all this bullshit.
And
making money
and
for somebody.
Yeah, and making money. And I don't agree with that. You know,
right.
That's why you see all these
articles
now.
It's supposed
now,
to be uncomfortable.
It's supposed to be uncomfortable. You have to take your body someplace it hasn't been before in order to affect a response. And as you get better and better and better and closer and closer and closer to your goal, it becomes harder and harder. It has to become harder and harder and harder. You can't continue to do what you've always done and continue to make progress at that same pace or at all.
Are you listening to this, Mike?
No.
This message is for you specifically.
And I tell this story because it's the same thing with nutrition. Do you come in the gym and do you pick the leg extension or do you pick the squat rack?
Right.
You know, do you start a nutrition program and do you pick candy bars? Well, I'm going to say candy bars, but protein bars or a shake, or do you pick steak and eggs
right.
and chicken.
Right.
Do you do what's most effective is my point. And then after that, we just talked about Rich Froning. He drinks whole milk because that's all he can do. That's the best he can do at that time, understanding his workload. He can't eat a whole meal.
Right.
So you do what, you know, the best that you can do every step of the way to get
right.
your nutrition in. And I just, in my mind, the best is always, if somebody asks me, what would you prefer? I'd prefer to eat my food.
Right.
I didn't take a single supplement when I won my pro card and trained with Flex. I didn't take a single supplement when I trained with you, nor did you recommend one.
Right.
Not a
right.
single one, not a single protein shake, protein bar, no pre-workout, none of it. I didn't take a single thing. Now, I'm a big fan of, say, like vitamin D3, maybe a multivitamin, even though the research suggests that that's worthless.
Right. Yeah.
But the doctors who did the research said,
right.
this stuff doesn't, you don't need to take these, but I take one.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Vitamin D3 is a supplement or vitamin you can get from the sun, right?
Yeah, we just don't get enough.
It's kind of said that we don't get enough sunlight nowadays. And
yep. Yeah.
You take some creatine to cover your bases or
yeah, you know,
else?
You can. Another thing about the creatine research shows is that it does give you a response. It's effective for about 30 days or so. And then, but after 90 days, people who did take it and people who didn't take it but employed the same training program had about the same.
End up in the same place.
End up at the same place. So
right.
it's hard to say what's the long-term benefit of
right.
it. You know, but then we're in the industry where 1% is a big deal.
Right.
And so you try and throw in all these little 1%s. And I talk about nutrition that way. I talk about it in terms of 99% and 1%. All the supplements go into the 1%.
Right.
Combined together go into the 1%. And then your nutrition program goes into the 99%. And that's just consistency with training hard, eating well, sleeping well. That's all your 99%. And those are the things that I was so disciplined about
right.
over the years was that I always slept. I always ate. I always trained.
Right.
Consistently.
Probably more disciplined than anybody I've ever met. You know, I've never seen anything like it. You, I remember you whipped out like a chart. You know, you showed me like this.
I keep a chart.
I eat this.
I still
this
do.
Time,
I'm not even competing. Know? I still checklist every single day whether or not I got my 8 hours of sleep, when I got my meals in, what I weighed in the morning, what my peak lifts were. Everybody always wants to show me their 2 years of their training log. And I look at that, and I'm that's great. That shows me 2 years of all the muscle you've broken down. Now, show me the muscle that you built up.
What did you eat?
Yeah, what did you eat? What was your sleep like? You know,
right.
When those things are in tune, if you're going to get 5 hours of sleep and take creatine, you're an idiot.
Right.
You know, you're stepping over $100 bills to pick up nickels. And we do the same thing. We talk the same thing about with women who do cardio at 4 a.m. in the morning after 4 hours of sleep. Well, you're burning half fat and half muscle,
yeah,
because you put yourself in that position. I would rather have you sleep and skip the cardio.
Yeah, right.
You know, so I mean, all of these things, they're the 1%.
Right.
And if you don't have the other stuff in order, then there's no sense even talking about it.
From a regulation standpoint, of your auto regulation standpoint, sleep is always going to be a better option than.
Basically, he just told all the 100,000 listeners that you're all fucking lazy and that you should quit. Double your efforts or fucking quit.
On top of the basics, nutrition and sleep, you know, those are kind of the top two, I'd say, for recovery. Is there anything else you do? You know, some people are really into ice baths or stim machines or foam
bigger, stronger,
rolling,
faster.
Or bigger, stronger, faster. Or is there anything else that you do to make sure that recovery can go through, like daily or on a workout day?
Stim machines, I've had good benefit from that, because particularly in powerlifting, because when you're laying there trying to recover from workouts, your lymphatic system's not pumping the garbage out, and you need to have good blood.
I think
flow.
You have a Mark Pro.
Yep, yeah. I got the Mark
Pro.
We're
big homies. Yeah.
And I believe that those are very effective. The ice baths haven't proven to be very effective.
What about a gay ice bath? Is that different than a regular ice bath?
Because that incorporates a massage, and now you've got blood flow. So.
Mm.
Yeah, what about massage
to
soft
all the right
tissue?
Spot.
You do that monthly
now,
or weekly? Or
you know, massage, the problem with those things like massage, stretching, foam rolling, is they're temporary. They're very temporary. They're kind of doing a little something while you're doing it. I used to, when I was powerlifting, I would take a recumbent bike into my room, and about every hour or so, I would just kind of spin my legs on it, because it would help with that lymphatic system pump, and now you're getting that blood flow more consistently throughout the day. You're going to recover faster. I call it active recovery, you know, and just about every good, collegiate athlete and professional athlete program has active recovery. For athletes, and particularly for injuries. You know, if you twist an ankle or you hurt a knee or something, and it's not something that requires
surgery.
You got
to get yourself moving.
You got to get it moving. You know, hip replacement surgery, the next morning you're walking. They got to get you moving.
Right.
Eric Spoto just had his shoulder surgery. Sent him home with a machine that for 4 hours would move his arm, you know, passive movement. Because it was, you know, before you might put ice on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I discovered, well, that's a detriment. You know, mm-hmm. that's impeding recovery. So now it's just active recovery, and can you do that without stressing the joint or the muscles or the ligaments that are hurt? So that's why they'll use the submerged treadmills or the
have
you do the suspended walk on a treadmill.
Yeah,
with
those things are amazing.
Machine.
You're like floating in air,
and if you keep moving that joint, you know, somebody asked me, "My ankle's sore. Should I wrap it?" Well, compression's good, but movement has to be in there too. So you know you have to find some way to move that joint. And then without putting too much load on it such that you're continuing to injure it.
Right.
But that all kind of – I use that research and kind of my own experience as to what works the best, because obviously I've had enough workouts over the years and tried enough things to see, well, hey, this is leading to some sort of significant success, not just a temporary benefit like a massage. You're just as sore a couple hours later.
Right.
Yeah.
Some things some people may not know about you or might know about you, but when I stayed at your house in Washington, there on the lake.
I had 5 bedrooms. Why did you stay in my room with me?
Not only did I stay
in
your
room. You probably slept in every single one.
And you kept taking the pillow wall down.
I know. There is no pillow wall. I not only did I sleep in your bed, but I also tried on all your clothes. I tried on many of your watches and sunglasses. You have a wonderful watch collection. No, but that was a beautiful home. And I remember... you know, I remember going through there and seeing a phantom, seeing like I think maybe some like a jet ski and seeing all kinds of other cars I don't even know the name of because I don't know fancy cars all that well. But what was that life about? Like, what was the build up to some of that? And, you know, what business did you have and how the fuck did all that happen?
You know, ever since I started bodybuilding and powerlifting, I realized it wasn't going to be a career. It was never going to pay me any money. And I don't know how I realized that way back then.
Unless you did gay for pay.
Yes.
Like that, Silent Mike.
That's the only way to make a little extra
money in the bank.
Yeah, a little scratch.
But so I always kept my day job, and a lot of people ask me now about their bodybuilding career or about their, you know, figure physique career in this industry. And the first thing I got to help them do is understand that it's not a career.
It's a hobby.
It's a hobby, and it's something that you do because you enjoy it, and nobody's going to pay you any money. Nobody's going to knock on your door and hand you a sponsorship. It does not exist.
I'm still waiting, everyone that's listening.
There's a handful of guys in the world that make enough money off of the sport to actually make a living. Right. 99% of the guys I know, and I've been around the industry, obviously. I'm an insider. I've talked to these guys. Generally, they're broke and wishing and wanting and hoping that someday they're gonna break through or somehow get
right.
The sponsorship.
Well, if there is a sponsorship, just to be clear, most people are only making a few $1,000s a month. Right. You know? I've heard 500 up to about 2,000, which is nice money. It's some extra income, but if you have a family, if you have a lot of things to support, it's not enough.
Hardly even pays for the cost of the sport.
Right,
it doesn't
right.
pay your rent or your car payment. It doesn't. Right. It hardly pays for the food and any supplements you might take. So it's not a career. Okay, it's a passion. Now some people can build a career out of the sport by having some sort of marketable, by monetizing their popularity in the sport. Whether or not they build a big following on the internet and then have something to sell, be it a clothing line or personal training. Any kind of supplement line, but you've got to, you have to be the person creating that opportunity for yourself.
Dana Lynn Bailey.
Yeah.
Comes to mind.
Nobody's going to come hand you money. You have to have something, some way to monetize your popularity and your physique.
It's a constant hustle.
It is a constant hustle. So that having been said, I think just about anybody in this industry, before I get into kind of the specifics of what I did, I've always believed and I've always said that anybody in this industry who's successful as an athlete has all the characteristics necessary to become a wealthy individual.
Right.
Because it's not about how smart you are. It's about consistency, time management, discipline. That's really the characteristics, the intangibles.
Yeah.
And, now that I have kids, of course, I'm always looking to see how I can best educate them. And all the best research suggests the same thing. That it's about consistency, time management. Those are the things that you have to kind of instill in an individual that gets them, the people that are most likely to complete college are the people who are consistent, have good time management skills.
Really, that's what college kind of proves.
That's what it
is
proves.
Is that you went through a bunch of other shit that other people, maybe some other people didn't go through.
Right. Yeah. It's a certification in a lot of ways.
Yeah, and you were able to hang on for 4 years and you're able to get the degree.
If you're not motivated and if you're a procrastinator, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mike.
Yeah, it's not for you. So that was always the biggest thing. Now, with respect to my business, I'd always worked for other people. I'd helped them make money and I worked hard and I was always... but I was learning as I went along. I worked for a real estate mentor who taught me how to
develop. Did you go to college?
I did go to college. I went to the University of Oregon. I earned a degree in psychology, and then I studied exercise science for 2 years after that, anatomy and kines and phys and physics. And
so you're 23, 24 when you got out of there?
Something like that.
Right.
Yep. And then I went to work just working at an apartment community for doing maintenance. It was just the job I could get at the time. Nobody's handing out big paying jobs.
Just handyman stuff?
Handyman stuff, yep. And so eventually the owner was helping me learn to grooming me for management and development. And so we built a 200-unit community, and I had a good opportunity to see all that happen. So, I was mentored. The point is that I had some sort of skill set that I had developed just from, learning.
Right.
When you start a business, you want to start something that's in your wheelhouse, something that you have an understanding about. And during that time, I'd also learned about telephone and cable services because we were providing them to our residents.
Right.
And then I went and I ran a 1,200-unit community in Denver, Colorado, and same thing. You learn about property management. You learn about finances and budgeting, and you learn about staffing and having a lot of employees, and also about more about the cable and telephone industry. And so an opportunity came up where I was offered a job as vice president of a telecommunications company up in Seattle. So I went up and I ran that company and helped build that company into a multimillion-dollar company in just over about a two-year period. And eventually the time came. I was probably in my mid-early 30s.
Were you jacked then?
Yeah, I was. I was still, I was still, 270 plus right in there. But then I just decided to start my own business, and I stopped, doing all this work every day, 12, 14 hours a day for somebody else. Started doing it for myself.
What year are we looking at? Like late 90s, maybe?
Yeah, late 90s. And the challenge is that being able to walk away from a paycheck,
right?
And
yeah, what was that like?
Well, it's scary because now you're having to fulfill payroll and you're having to figure out, and you take considerable...
But you were single at the time.
I was single at the time. You take considerable risk and you sell everything you have. You run up credit card debt.
It's scary to have an employee.
Yes.
You're paying, for their Christmas and shit like that. It starts to get a little weird when you start to actually think about it.
Well, you feel responsible, not just for your own company, but every employee and their family. And
right,
and,
yeah, yeah.
They have kids. After a while, the risk, it's okay when you're single, and it's okay when, you're going to fall
on your own. It's on you.
It's on you.
Yeah.
It's probably okay when you're doing well, too, though.
Yeah, eventually. But you worry that when you fail, or if you fail, that, everybody that works for you is also, going to suffer from that experience. But, I tell you, it was... I started my own phone company after...
Did you have some investors, or you kind of just went
No,
out?
Okay, didn't have any investors. I just ran up...
Take a loan?
I ran up about $100,000 in credit card debt. I just applied for every card that somebody would give me, and I was using new cards to pay off old cards with cash advances. I was paying my employees with those little checks, the checkbooks that the credit card company gives you.
Right.
That was payroll. I'd sold my home, but, there's only about $40,000 that I could put in.
Only lasts for so long,
401k was small, and then... I started leveraging my vendors. I was buying products from – I was selling phone service, and I was buying products from the telephone companies, but I wouldn't pay them for 90 days. It's a very different business when you're trying to collect money and then pay in arrears than when you're paying up front and trying to collect money later. But, it was a hard slog. I started out of my apartment and had a few employees in the living room, answering phones during the day. And we were going door to door, knocking on doors, trying to sell phone service in communities. And a lot of no's. It was a tough business at the end of the day to get, 10 or 12 customers. And,
right.
I was eating at McDonald's every day because I was broke. I was eating dollar meals at McDonald's in the morning and the dollar meals at lunch.
Once you started your own business, were you able to train?
No. I was working too many hours. I was too broke. You feel like it's kind of like...
You couldn't put time into yourself.
No, and you feel like with training... everything that you do if you're competing, everything you do outside of competing can be a distraction, can be a detriment. You want to make sure you get every workout in, every meal in, every rest, every, sleep period.
So if you can't do all that, then there's no point in your opinion, your mind.
If you're going to compete at if you want to be the best,
right.
If you want to win.
Right.
And it was the same thing for me in business is that everything else became a distraction. Why would I go to the gym when I could spend another hour working in my business?
Right.
Because that was my competition at the time, was to try and grow this company. And I was, I was leveraged. I was in debt. I was broke. So the point being is that if you can commit that kind of time and energy and consistency and discipline to your bodybuilding, and people do this for 5 years, 10 years, 15 years plus, I say anybody who has who commits that kind of time and discipline into any income producing venture could be a millionaire in 5 years,
right?
And probably less. And
a little creativity, little direction.
A little creativity, a little direction, but maybe just using what things you're good at, And I had a little experience, in the telecommunications business, so I was able to start that business. But then it was just after that, it's 1% inspiration, 99% perspiration. And after that, it was just a grind. It was every single day out there hustling, trying to get...
Did you have some sort of breakthrough?
I did, yeah. Eventually, we were able to build up to where we had enough regular customers so we could start running commercials on TV.
Was there any sort of merger with a bigger company or anything like that that happened that allowed you to have this growth, or still just grinding it out?
Just grinding it out. And once we were able to start, eventually you can start marketing to a larger group of people. And back then we started being able to buy in small markets television advertising, and then the phone.
What's an example of a company that has telephone service, like AT&T, or is that different?
Yeah, we were doing the same thing at the time as MCI. You remember the neighborhood back then, MCI, you'd see a commercial every 15 seconds on TV. Mm-hmm. We were selling the same service. We were reselling local dial tone in a number of different markets.
And does that mean you have people that are putting up telephone wires and stuff? I have no idea what any of this means.
No, MCI was reselling the local carrier service, say Quest or Bell South or the like. Okay. They were reselling using, get too technical, but it was UNIPs, unbundled network elements, and the phone companies had to sell them those lines at what they called forward-looking rates. They had to sell them those lines it was a really good discount at the time.
Right.
But of course, the big phone companies lobbied the FCC. The FCC changed the ruling, said they no longer had to sell those phone lines at those rates. They tripled their prices. MCI went bankrupt. Everybody remembers when MCI went bankrupt. Well, I was in business selling the same lines at the time MCI went bankrupt. Being a smaller company and not having the overhead and the debt, I was able to specialize in some of the lower-income markets and some of the less expensive markets that were closer to the phone companies were cheaper than the rural markets. And so I could specialize. So eventually, with running commercials and stuff, we built slowly but surely over the course of a number of years into 20 states serving 100,000 customers.
Jesus.
I had 100 employees answering over 5,000 calls a day.
Wow.
We were running television commercials in all those states, and we built that we were grossing probably $25, $30 million a year on that business.
Wow.
It took a number of years, and I thought I was going to go out of business many, many times in the process, but it eventually built up. And during that time, the real estate market was good, and I had that experience in the development and multifamily, so I started buying apartment communities. And at that time, you could buy a condo conversion opportunity, apartment community, for about 1% down. Mm. It was amazing. So you could get, a $10 million property for $100,000.
Yeah, wow.
Because you'd go to the bank and you'd show them that if I convert this to condos and resell it, it's got this much equity already in it.
Right, built in. Yeah.
Yep. And they would lend to you based on its potential, not on its worst case scenario.
It's leveraged, but it's not a bad bet.
Right.
On anybody's part.
And so
as long
I ended
as you
up,
execute.
I bought and sold probably $100 million in real estate over a five-year period. I built single-family subdivisions, had some commercial property. Mostly it was multifamily. Some we operated as apartment communities, and some we converted into condos and sold off. And then the market crashed late 2007, 2008. And immediately overnight, you couldn't sell a single thing.
Shit.
And now you're...
You kind of mentioned to me when I first met you that if you would have sold a little bit before that time period, that you would have been able to kind of just cash out and just live high off the hog the rest of your life.
Yeah, and that's what happens. Everybody thought real estate was the safest investment in the world, but it tanked from anywhere from 25 to 70% throughout the country, depending on what market you were in. People remember, I think, all too clearly that there were folks that lost everything.
Yeah,
there were guys jumping in front of trains, and it was a tough time. But I didn't grow up with money. I didn't look at money as the be all end all. It was the process for me, and so we just mitigated the damages, sold off what we could sell off, continued to operate what we could continue to operate. Harvested whatever cash and assets we had left, and reinvested in another company. After that market crashed, and I went to bed on a Friday night probably worth $20 million, and if you looked at your paper value in real estate, and Monday morning the banks are calling me asking me for money to pay down debt to equity ratios on properties that they now deem to be worth less than my value. So that's an interesting position to be in, and all you can do is weather the storm, and that's what we did. And we started another company, an engineering firm, and it's been 5-6 years now, and that firm had a real difficult road to start out initially, but a long grind, a lot of debt, a lot of hard work. But it's successful, and we service Boeing and Lockheed Martin. We do work for the Transportation Safety Administration, big contract with Walmart recently, and a lot of stuff pending. So, it's just a matter of staying in there and staying in the grind.
Right.
What I see you saying is that what we see a lot in the market right now is fitness
bodybuilding, whatever, people who have made themselves into celebrities, and they cash in on that with a clothing line, a supplement, blah, 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 blah. What you did was take the same discipline that you put into bodybuilding, into powerlifting, whatever, and you were applying it to business.
Yeah.
In unrelated industries.
Yep, absolutely. I never made a penny off the fitness industry. Actually, it's cost me a lot of money, right, just to be able to do the things I've done. But I've learned so much and been able to travel so much and train with so many people. The exposure I've been able to get from it has been extraordinary. And the knowledge I think that I've acquired is unique to being able to meet with and train with and learn from some of these great minds who have spent many, many, many years on just mm-hmm. one aspect. Mm-hmm. And if you're the guy that gets to travel around and talk to all these people, then you kind of know a little bit of it all.
Right. And kind of what I see that Mark has done that's different is that he came up with a great product, and right now, obviously, his notoriety helps sell the product. But the fact that the product works is what helps sell the product.
It's a little different than a T-shirt.
Right, exactly.
Well, that's the huge thing. And that's what I've done recently with the cooler invention is that I've been thinking on this thing for a long time, and then watching Mark launch his product, I decided to go ahead and make this thing and bring it to market. And
we've motivated each other, buddy.
Yep, absolutely. And I've thought many times about getting in doing a supplement line, et cetera, but what you just said is what was more important to me. Does the product work? How
right.
does it stand alone from every other Tom, Dick, and Harry in the market, like you say, with a T-shirt business or a pre-workout? Or I couldn't get hungry about that. I couldn't get interested in that, even though some companies can make some money on that.
Right.
It just never appealed to me. If it wasn't something that was somewhat unique and didn't serve a particular purpose that 100 other people weren't already serving,
right,
then I wasn't really interested in it.
So, yeah, you wanted to believe in it. You want to explain the cooler a little bit to people, what's going on?
Yeah, tell us kind of its origin, too. Where did it come from?
Yeah, I used to carry around a cooler to the gym. I'd bring in my own ice water or pre-workout or something.
Yeah, I remember you used to do that super training.
Yeah, I'd always bring in something. It was maybe just some branch chain aminos, maybe throw in a little 50 grams of carb powder of some sort, and maybe a
little Diana ball.
Yeah, if I could sprinkle it up and flavor it, put it in there. And maybe like a Nun tablet or something. I don't know, just whatever you decided to bring in. And then there was always the post-workout deal, and if you brought in water, then you had a pre-workout, and the pre-workout was warm. Or if you brought in a gallon jug in a plastic milk jug or whatever, then it was warm, and you'd drink that all day, and it would taste like plastic after it sat in your car. Mm-hmm. And then post-workout, you'd have to get a shake or something, and it was, you're blending it with warm water . So I figured what I would do is...
basically, you come into the gym with multiple...
Yeah, I wanted to bring all of this, all of my, hydration, post-workout nutrition, whether it be a shake or something like that, or chocolate milk for, whoever wants to do that,
mm-hmm.
And have it available for me and cold and ready to use. So I invented this cooler concept where I put my shaker bottles down inside the cooler to stay cold with the ice water in the perimeter while I was training, so I could drink my pre-workout, pop it back into the cooler where it would stay cold. The cooler was full of water, or the cooler could be full of, the aminos and what have
right.
you. Then post-workout, I could have a shake, and I could fill it with ice water from my jug. And it was all there and convenient for me. So that's kind of why I invented this thing to use that. And I think it appeals in particular to, kids who are doing sports like football and soccer and lacrosse and things like that. They're always carrying their water jug out onto the field.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But now people are becoming more and more aware that it's not just water. There's got to be some sort of nutrition. The post-workout, meal replacement, particularly the carbohydrates and maybe a little protein. Even parents are becoming more and more knowledgeable about that. They're giving their kids glutamine or lysine or creatine, they're student athletes, they're teenage.
Yeah, a lot of times it's extremely important to have something post-workout because oftentimes it's going to be too long until you get to your next meal.
Yeah.
Until you get to your next chance to have food, basically.
What's funny about that? We're kids and we're playing soccer and the parents always bring like oranges for halftime or after the game. Mm. It's just good nutrition, what have you.
Right.
And then I go and I work with kids, and the parents are all concerned about, well, don't bring sugar snacks, you know,
right,
post-workout. We want you to bring healthy foods.
Which orange is for...
Yeah, that's their idea. But then, of course, now we know the research suggests that sugar is exactly what you do need.
Right.
Right.
But the parents have this association with sugar is bad, but don't understand the benefit, the nutritional benefit of it. But they're getting more educated about it. They're trying to give their kids something, and that's their choice. You know, whatever it is their research compels them to provide for their kids, they understand that there's has to be a nutritional value of some sort, whether they decide to do chocolate milk or they decide to do a post-workout protein shake or they decide to do, you know, a snack, even cheese snacks or whatever, could go in and stay cool in this thing. If you're a mom with and you're going to the park with a baby, you can put a baby bottle in this thing and it stays cool.
Oh, I thought
cool.
You were going
to
say you could put a baby in there.
You could put a baby in there and keep it cool. But, you know, the point is that we're just trying to find a way to keep perishable items cold throughout an intense workout so you can consume those post-workout, you know, more affordably and more conveniently.
Yeah, I remember like the first time you kind of showed me the concept, and it was just you just had a shaker cup kind of sitting inside of a tub of water,
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
And you're like, you know, I want to make something that has, you know, so it keeps it cold, but it's not getting wet and stuff like that.
Yeah, I took my post-workout shake, and I stuffed it inside of a one-gallon ice
like Gatorade
water
jug. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was there when I was done training.
Right.
And then I figured, well, people probably don't want to handle that in the gym.
Yeah, yeah,
put
it's
it
all
back
wet.
In, yeah, you know, after they've touched the weights.
Yeah, they might not want to be as hardcore about it as you. Yeah.
Right. And so I just made one that was, you know, it was separated by a plastic sleeve from the water on the outside, and then also offered the opportunity to put in a, you know, a set, because there's two shaker bottles down in there. And so you can have an opportunity to put a protein powder in the one shaker for storage, and the other one can be liquid. So it took probably 18 months to bring that to the point where that's
right.
Actually the ship's coming to shore. I had to get an engineer. We had to design it. We had to manufacture it. The manufacturer would send me samples. They'd have to be changed and altered and adjusted.
You could pop out two babies in that time.
Yeah, well, I almost did. I've got a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, and they're both here before the cooler.
Stan Jr. and Milena?
Malia. Milani, the baby.
Milani.
My wife, yeah.
Right.
Yep, she's turned 3 next month, and Stan Jr.'s 1.
How's that feel to have kids?
Oh, it's great. It's great. You know, one of the biggest things I learned is that I used to always prioritize, you know, something else. And myself.
Yourself.
Probably.
There you go. Stan, yeah. Efforting. Yeah, we know.
Yeah, whether it be bodybuilding, powerlifting, business, et cetera, et cetera. None of that seems all that important anymore. It's funny, you know.
Right.
And everything you do now, you don't do for yourself. You do for them. And so the decision-making process in terms of the business or –
right.
You know, whatever.
It's interesting, though, when you do stuff for your kids, it's not hard. You know, like sometimes when you're doing stuff for yourself, like you're not always dying to go to the gym.
Right.
You're not always dying to go to the gym. But if you have to help your kid tie their shoe, it's not something that you need to, like, motivate yourself.
No,
to
and that's a sense of it's accomplishment
just, boom, just
for
done.
Me.
Right.
So it is. It's been a great and I, you know, I always say I started too late. I'm 47 now. And so you know, I'll be 63 before I drop Stan Jr. off to college, and I just think that
or at super training,
yeah, or at super training.
And I, here you go, son, go learn how to deadlift.
I just kept thinking I was waiting for the right time, you know.
Yeah.
And there's no such thing. And now there's that I see that how rewarding it is, I run around telling all my 30-something friends, "Oh, you better get started. You better get started."
The 40-year-old virgin.
Don't be mean. Yeah.
I hear so often anymore guys in their 20s saying, "Oh, I don't want to have kids," or "I don't want
that's
to
me."
Yeah, but you know. Like, you're missing out. I think if you're going to suck as a parent, obviously don't do it. But if you don't do it, if you feel like at all that it would work for you, you know, we need smart people to have babies. I'm sorry. If you've been to Walmart, you know that we need smart people to have babies.
Yeah, yeah. And, I, you know, one of the biggest things about it is you know, I see folks that had kids in their 20s, they almost look like this. I'm like the old guy at high school when I take my stepson is 15, and when I take him to high school, I'm like the old guy because everybody there's in their 30s. Mm-hmm. The parents, you know, are younger.
Your stepson's that huge kid that's at your house, right?
Yeah, my goodness. And
that's
just started.
Boy.
He just started working out maybe a year and a half ago.
Yeah, you have him working out. You're waking him up early to eat and everything, right? He's playing football and stuff, right?
Oh yeah, yeah. But you know, he's Samoan. And he's 6'1", 305.
Wow.
You say he was 15?
And he's 15 years old, yeah. And he's just enormous. But we take him.
Do you even bother to tell him to clean his room?
No.
Or does he tell you to clean yours?
I try to hide the steaks in the fridge, and he'll go in and find them and eat them. I don't say anything. I just leave him be. Because the kid grows like a weed. It's amazing. But I don't even train him personally because I felt as though I couldn't. I wouldn't push him as hard as I thought I want to.
Right.
And B, he might look at that differently.
Right.
If he see, you know, he doesn't see me as a coach. You know, right. He sees me as a parent. And so it could become some sort
of
conflict.
Become negative. Yeah.
It could become negative as though I was yelling at him. So I take him to Mark Phillippe's there in town.
Yeah.
And they do an extraordinary job. He's doing everything that I would wish that I would have him do, but he does it with a sense of positivity and accomplishment as opposed to
That's awesome. You know, it's just all about providing kids with opportunities, you know, opportunities maybe that we didn't have. So,
you know, I think so
that's
too.
Really cool.
And what's your brother's movie that he worked on there for a long time? The one about the trophy kids.
Oh yeah. Trophy kids. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was pretty intense.
And you mentioned something like you just said, you just want to provide him the opportunity.
Yeah.
And
the same thing with my kids. You know, people ask me all the time, am I going to teach them how to lift? Like, I might show them how to lift, but if they give resistance and they don't want to do it, then they don't want to do it. You know?
Yeah, I lifted because I wanted to. Nobody was in the garage. My dad bought the weight set and put it out there, but he didn't come out and try and take me through a program. I was out there doing it because I enjoyed doing it. I would bring the weights into the kitchen and curl them in front of my mom when she was cooking. Look, Mom, look. Yeah, I'm 12 years old, and I'm curling in the kitchen because I wanted them to see.
I remember your mom, when we put you on the cover of Power, she was so proud of you. It was really cute. She sent us an email, and she was just all excited and everything. She wanted some copies, and that was after we sent you like 1,000 copies, so you couldn't even send your mom one copy.
No, I'm keeping all those.
But I remember she was so proud of you, and she sent us like in the email, she was like, I remember, you know, when Stan was a kid, when he was like 7 or 8 years old, he had 2 or 3 jobs, and he was already like, you know, into all this stuff. And it was just really cool to hear that from her, that you were already motivated at such a young age, you know?
Yeah, and I think that's important. I think that's what I look for, to see what motivates an individual, because that's where you can help them succeed. If you try and, you know, provide them your idea or, you know, your motivation, you're not going to have much luck with it. You can only kind of help channel and inform and educate somebody in the direction that they're inclined to go.
Right? The real shock is when you figure out that they have qualities that you don't have, like positive qualities that you do not possess. That's like, oh, man, I missed out. I somehow the genetics skipped me, and I can't do this thing, or I don't have that. I can't think that way.
Yeah.
I can't remember that.
We're going to wrap this thing up, but a question that you probably get asked nonstop that we might as well share with people. And I know you're going to say it's consistency and everything else, but maybe you can give people a little bit of insight on maybe a little bit of a program that they can do. People probably ask you all the time, how do you get such big arms? So if you can leave us with a little bit of a curling program or tricep program or something along those lines that somebody could perhaps start to implement to get larger pipes.
I think the basics is what develop the arms. I think when you do a pronated or a supinated chin-up, you're going to get more benefit for your biceps than when you do a curl. I like to see things done through multi-joint exercises. I like to see things done through free weight or exercises that use a straight bar. Overhead presses, I think, are huge for triceps and shoulders. Some close grip presses. I'm just not a big fan of the isolation exercises per se. I think that's a supplement to the basics. And then from there, you're definitely going to have to get some sort of volume in. You can't do it with singles and doubles. You're going to have to.
Right.
So arms for me, I always try to work the brachialis with a close grip, hands facing, and then try to work the biceps by reversing my grip, you know, supinating my hands. So I was doing all my pulling movements, my back rows, my T-bar rows,
palms up.
Yeah, with my palms up or at least facing each other so I could involve more bicep work. But chins were huge, overhead presses. Tricep, the large head of the tricep, the long head, is worked when your elbow's pointed at the ceiling. And that's – everybody tends to do most of the tricep exercises with push-downs. Mm. And so I want to make sure that everybody's program, when I do triceps, that they incorporate some sort of movement with their – elbow facing up towards the ceiling. And another, you know, the shoulder press kind of gets a little of that too.
Right.
The overhead press.
Yeah, like a French press or something.
Yeah, and then I have to watch my elbows because once your once your tendons start flaring up with those skull
being crushers, on top is good for your triceps, right?
That's good too. That's those static holds are important.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it depends on how long you can last. Like, if you only last 3 minutes, maybe it's not so much of a tricep workout.
Right, but you can wear a slingshot and last 6 minutes.
Oh, yeah, oh. I know.
But wow. Hey, it helps with sensitivity, huh?
Yeah, you didn't know the added benefit.
Look at that.
Then do it two a day, you know?
Then it just kind of, like, rests right over her face, kind of, and then never mind.
We always end up here.
I know. How does that happen?
We've been remarkably clean this episode.
I appreciate you.
I didn't hear one F-bomb the whole episode.
That was pretty good.
Fuck.
There we go.
Yeah. Okay, now I have to put that demo.
I appreciate you not wearing any pants for this podcast and wearing your posing trunks. It was wonderful.
Yeah. And my dumbbells.
And your 5-pound dumbbells.
I was training while we were
anything talking. Coming up that you want to share with people? You got anything going on?
Just the cooler. That's the biggie. We're going to be at a lot of places this year. We're going to be all four Europa shows in Atlantic City and Orlando and at in Dallas, Texas, and Phoenix, Arizona, headed to...
maybe at the Olympia again?
Going to be at the Olympia again, going to be at FIBO here in a few weeks in Germany, and then headed to Australia in May to for a powerlifting meet down there to an invitation. It's a GPC, isn't it, that's down there?
Are you going to lift?
Well, I hope I didn't. It's in Brisbane, Australia. I'm not going to... Well, you know, I'm gonna do a poll. I'm going to see if I can deadlift something. It's kind of been harder to hit the big lifts at my new body weight, but I'm going to see if I can deadlift something respectable.
Are you going to get way into it and get big, or are you going to try to just stay where you're at?
No, I'm going to stay right where I'm at. I'm going to be I wake up right in the low 250s, 252, 254 maybe on a big day, and I'm going to try and stay right there and see if I can eke out a
don't bench press. That would be embarrassing.
That would be – I don't bench or squat anymore. I just show videos. But the dead I might be able to
look what I used to
something.
Do. That's me.
Yeah, some guy, I was telling this story to Eric Littlebridge the other day. Some kid came up to me in the gym and he goes, "Do you powerlift?" And I thought, oh, yeah. He must know me.
Please. And, kidding me? Do I powerlift? What kind of question is that?
Yeah, so I turn around and I'm like, boy, yes, I do. Or I used to. And he goes, oh, do you know Eric Littlebridge?
That's great.
And
that's
I looked, awesome. I kind of cocked my head and looked at the kid. Like, he didn't know me.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so and he walked away. Damn it.
You're like, what do you deadlift? 837. Oh, Eric's a lot stronger than you. Walked away.
No, that's another good story. I have to tell that one, too. We're at the gym, and we're lifting, and Eric Spoto was benching. And some kid comes up, and he goes, well, how much do you bench? And Eric's like, oh, 700. And the kid goes, oh, and turns around and starts to walk away. Yeah, and at the time, Creed was there, and Creed's like, no, wait. And he follows the kid across the gym and grabs him. He goes, what do you mean? He goes, oh, I got a friend that benches 800.
That's great.
Yeah. So he had to explain to him the whole geared versus raw thing. Yeah.
You said
one
Eric
person at a time.
Spoto was pretty much the biggest freak you've ever lifted with, right?
Absolutely.
He just give us some examples of some crazy shit that he does. I mean, I'm aware of some of the numbers, but
oh, I mean, it's
even just accessory and assistance work, he's using tons of weight, right?
Yeah. Everything he touches, it's just amazing how powerful he is. You know, what's funny about Eric is that he was squatting 675 for triples in high school. He was known for his squat, not his bench.
Yeah.
Even though he benched over 400 in high school. But he got in a motorcycle accident. He broke his ankle. He's got some pins in the bar.
He can still squat pretty good, though.
He can still squat pretty good.
He moves really well.
He'll throw a safety squat bar on, put 500 pounds on there, and knock out 10, 12 reps on a box like it's nothing. He's just powerful. I've never seen anybody so strong. He was an arm wrestler, too, and if you lock up with him with his hand.
Oh, it's insane.
Yeah, you just feel like a little girl.
Yeah, you feel so weak.
This guy. And I'd go in there and I was benching 500 for, you know, 6-7 reps every time I'd go in the gym. And I'd put 500 on and I'd get 5-6 reps. Eric would add a plate, close grip it, and knock out, you know, more than your max. You'd go in there on a big day and you'd hit like a 585, you know, and Eric added a plate and tripled to 675. And makes it look easy. The best video I think ever is the time that he did the 765 with the slingshot.
Yeah, I think he just posted it on Instagram, so I just rewatched it.
Yeah, it's amazing and I numbered the plates. I had the chalk out, so I numbered 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 plates. Right, 765 pounds. Now the slingshot does not help you at lockout.
No,
it only helps you when you get down and the thing starts to touch your bent, your chest. I've had 765 on my back to squat. And I've squatted a lot of weight, but it's a lot. 765 is
in your
heavy.
Hands. Yeah,
and he's just sitting there with it at arm's length, And he just brings it down and boop, just pops up like it's nothing.
Yeah, it looks like he had like three or four in him.
I've never seen him struggle. And on the second rep, actually, he did do a second rep. It went to the left. It went sideways on him. And so we had to grab it. But he was going to knock out two reps, no problem, at 765. Just the idea of holding that at arm's length.
Yeah.
You know, and the power that he has. And then all that accessory work. I mean, he did a shoulder press to the front with 500 pounds, did like three reps. And it was nothing. Just like Eric, he just brings it down his bloop, bloop.
Doesn't he like an overhead press like 180 pound dumbbells or something? Does he do it standing or something like that? Weird.
Yeah, you know, I haven't
seen
him
crazy
do that. But he'll load everything he can onto like a hammer strength back machine and just sit there and row it for repetitions. You know, like cardio. Long, huh? Yeah,
it's insanity.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen anybody so powerful in all of.
He's different too. I mean, most world record holders are very driven towards those numbers, and I know that he was driven towards the numbers too. But he was almost pushed into powerlifting; like he didn't even seem like he wanted to do it.
Well, he's not. Eric doesn't like having a lot of people around.
Yeah, he's shy. So
he's not a stage guy. He gets nervous and stuff. So he just likes to go to the gym and lift. Plus, he would never go over, like we talked about the other day, like 630 or 650.
Yeah,
even when he went to triple 675, he'd never done that before. It just kind of felt right that day. He always leaves reps in the tank. He never misses a lift in the gym. That's just, you know, he goes up very conservatively. Mm. The day he benched 705, he thought it was 695. We threw nickels on him. He was getting
tricked
a drink
him.
Of water. Yeah.
Did you ever try to press like him, where he presses before, you know, before it touches his shirt, he reverses the weight? You ever try that?
Mm-mm. I haven't tried it.
It's fucking hard.
I don't try to do anything Eric does. It's embarrassing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's humiliating.
Anyway, we better wrap this thing up. I think that's it.
Who's still listening?
No, hour and a half. No, no one's still listening.
If you're still listening, you have no life.
And if you are listening, you have no life. If you're not listening, you have no life. If you are listening, you have no life.
Where can people find you, Stan?
StanEfferding.com. Hit me up there, and you can email me and buy my shirt.
All your social media is on there, and your links to the cooler when it's available.
At Stan Efferding on Instagram.
Yep, got some t-shirts, some training stuff on there. Buy my shit.
There you go.
Hell yeah. Multiply your hustle, multiply your muscle. May all your shits be tapered. I'm at Mark Smelly Bell.
You can find me at Silent Mike with 2 Ks.
I'm Jim McD, STTV, everywhere that I would want you to find me, which is mostly Instagram and Twitter. Follow the show on Instagram at Mark Bell's Powercast, on Twitter at STJimSack, Facebook.com/SupertrainingJim, and check out supertraining.tv for tons of videos, including ones with our friend Stan Efferding.
Subscribe to Power Magazine at PowerMagazine.com. If you choose the digital edition, you can catch up on all the great back issues, take your training to the next level with Slingshot products at HowMuchYouBench.net, and look for PSN products including NO Explode at Bodybuilding.com. Mark Bell's PowerCast is a production of SuperTraining.tv.